Okay, so let's just try and see what happens then. Okay, of the four Nikayas, which is the most suitable for a layperson to study on its own without a teacher? Okay, that's a very nice question, because this means somebody is interested in the suttas, and that's always nice. So I would say that sometimes you don't even have to start with a particular Nikaya. There is one particular work which I would recommend everybody to read. It's called In the Buddha's Words. And in the Buddha's words is a compilation of suttas, and they have all been chosen by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And because it is a compilation, they are grouped according to theme. They have nice introductions. They have nice end notes, which explains what is going on. And I think that is actually quite a nice place to start. So In the Buddha's Word is a good place to start. Otherwise, I would always recommend people to have a look at the Dhammapada. You know the Dhammapada, right? Yeah? It has a lot of nice verses in there, very inspiring little things. And find a nice translator. There's so many, I think there's over 100 translations into English. So you have to find one which is nice, right? And there's a couple of nice ones. One is the one that was translated by Bhante Buddha Rakita. He was an Indian monk, and he made a translation that was published by the Buddhist Publication Society. It's quite nice. Another modern translation was done by a fellow called Gil Fronsdal, who is based in California. And that also is actually quite nice. It has quite a modern feel to it, and modern English, and quite easy to understand for that reason. So Dhammapada, I recommend, right? You go to bed at night, before you go to sleep, do a bit of meditation just to chill, read a couple of verses of Dhammapada, oh, so happy, and then go to sleep, right? It's a great way. It's so important to enjoy. When you go to sleep and you feel happy, you can sleep well and you can rest well. You have a sense of metta in your heart. You wake up in the morning, you have energy when you wake up in the morning, right? This is the way to go. And so always do the little tricks like that to kind of enjoy everything becomes more enjoyable in this sense. Another way of going about reading the suttas is just to take the Majjhima Nikaya. If you're going to take one Nikaya, I recommend the Majjhima Nikaya. The suttas there are very diverse, and they cover pretty much the entire field of Buddhism. But what is also nice about the Majjhima Nikaya, it has quite a few little stories in there. It has things about the biography of the Buddha. You see the Buddha in different situations, talking to different kind of people. You also get a nice feel for the Buddha himself, right, when you read the Majjhima Nikaya. And little stories that are very nice. Some suttas that are very profound. If it's something you can't read, forget about it, just skip it, move on to the next one. Suttas is not something you have to read from the beginning to the end, right? Majjhima Nikaya, start on page 1, end up on page 1200 or whatever it is. No need for that. You can read whichever sutta you like. Skip the sutta there, take another sutta somewhere. The disadvantage with the Majjhima Nikaya is that the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya is just about the most profound sutta in the entire Pali canon. So skip the first sutta. Don't start with that one. Start with number 3 maybe. Number 3 is quite good. And then you can move on from there and do the ones that inspire you. The other good thing about the Majjhima Nikaya is that there is, at the very beginning, there is an index, a short summary of each sutta. So you can read the short summary and think, oh, is this nice? Okay, this sounds good. And you can try that one and see how you go. Yes, but there are some suggestions for you right there, and see if any of that works out for you. And if it doesn't, then I will be gone before you have a chance to complain. So that's, I'm very, very lucky, right? I just disappear just in time. So this is called wisdom for you. This is a kind of basic wisdom. Always go first. Okay. Anyway, so let us move on to question number B. Bhante, Nama Buddhaya, Buddha praises monk in the forest, not the one near the village. Which sutta is this? Okay, it's found in the Anguttara Nikaya. I cannot give you the exact number now. It's found actually in a couple of places in the Anguttara Nikaya. But what I will do, I will find it for you after I go back to my room, just over here tonight, and I will bring it out tomorrow morning for you. Are you coming tomorrow morning? Whoever you are, you've got to promise to come tomorrow morning. Otherwise, I will be wasting my time. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you should never trust the teacher, right? So always ask for the sutta, so you can check it out for yourself. That's very wise of you. So, recommend it. Okay, was it Ananda's fault that the Buddha decided to take final Nibbana at 80 years of age? Okay, that's a good question, because in that sutta, I only read part of it, in that sutta, the Buddha says that he gives a hint, right, to Ananda. He says something like, oh, the Buddha could live on, you know, the Buddha has the power, he could live on for an eon if he wanted to. And then Ananda doesn't say, oh, please, please live on for the eon. Ananda, he says in the sutta, he's blinded by Mara. And because his mind is possessed by Mara, he's unable to see what he's supposed to be doing, right? So the Buddha gives this hint three times. Every time Ananda is blinded by Mara, so he doesn't ask the question. And then afterwards, the Buddha is supposed to have said, it is your fault, right? You should have asked me. I find the whole story so unconvincing. I don't know how that story could be real. I mean, first of all, the Buddha would have known that Ananda was deluded by Mara, right? Secondly, why would the Buddha make a decision based on what Venerable Ananda says? Surely the Buddha is capable of making his own decision. He doesn't make a decision on that kind of grounds, right? The whole thing to me has this feeling of some kind of myth that was passed down in later generation. Somebody thought, oh yeah, I remember some vaguely truth about that. So better put it into the sutta just in case, so it doesn't get lost, right? So they put these things in there. I must admit, I don't really believe that kind of stuff. To me, it sounds very unreasonable. The Buddha is supposed to have been the wisest person around from a Buddhist point of view. And then he makes a decision based on Venerable Ananda being blinded, on Mara coming to visit him, asking him, please, this is the time for you to take Parinibbana. And the whole thing just doesn't make any sense to me. I think it is much more likely that, remember the Buddha had already said before this, if you remember the story in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, just after he has finished a rains retreat at Vaisali, actually we were just reading that out before, the Buddha was suffering a lot during the end of that rains retreat, and then Ananda goes to him and says, oh, I can't have a sense of directions and all this kind of thing. Surely you will say something to the Sangha. And at that point, the Buddha is already saying that he will die in 3 months' time, right? So the whole thing doesn't really match very well. Everything is slightly strange. So I personally can't take that too seriously myself. I think there's some corruptions going on in that particular sutta. Somebody has added a few things just to make it sound nice, right? This is one of the problems there. And it's important to realize that the suttas are not entirely perfect. And this is one of the things that you realize when you do comparative study. You compare the Chinese Agama version of the Sutta, you compare it with the Pali, compare it with the Sanskrit, compare it with the Tibetan version, and you look at them all, and you see that there are certain differences. And when you see certain differences, you know that there has been a little bit of corruption in the Suttas over the centuries, over the millennia. It would be a miracle if there was no corruption. They have been out there for 2,500 years. That every word should be exactly the same after 2,500 years. It's very hard to believe that. There is to be expected that there should be a little bit of corruption in the suttas. Where you find the most corruption is in the narrative sections. By the narrative, I mean not where the Buddha is speaking, but in the kind of introduction. The Buddha was living in such and such a place, and it says at the end, in that time, the 100 monks became fully enlightened, right? That's the narrative. It's been added by somebody else. We know that because it's not the Buddha talking. And the most likely place that it was added was at the First Council. At the First Council, Mahakassapa asks Venerable Ananda, right? He asks him, where did the sutta take place? Who were the protagonists? Who was speaking at the time, right? All these questions were asked at the First Council. That means that information was not part of the sutta at that time. It would have been added around that time at the First Council. So we know from the history of the sutta that it was added later on. We also know that those narrative sections, they vary much more than the actual word of the Buddha. So generally the word of the Buddha is the most reliable part. The narrative section, sometimes it is good, but occasionally it is a little bit dubious. So please keep that in mind. But I have no doubt that the core teachings of the Buddha as we have them, they are exactly the same, or almost exactly the same across all the traditions. So you don't have to worry about practicing the wrong way. If you're doing mindfulness of breathing, you are safe. That every tradition in Buddhism has been teaching mindfulness of breathing in pretty much exactly the same way. 16 steps leading to Satipatthana, leading to the factors of awakening. You find that in the Chinese, you find it in the Pali. Not sure about the Tibetan, because Tibetans don't have that many early discourses, but it is fairly clear that that is an early part of the suttas. Right? Sila. Sila is in all the suttas, right? You can't go to the Chinese and say, oh, this Chinese doesn't have any sila, so don't have to do the sila. Sila is there everywhere as well, right? You can't get out of those things that easily here. Unfortunately, have some. Okay. So it's good to know that we have pretty much the word of the Buddha in the present day as well. Okay. Dear Ajahn, may we have some details or summary of what are stated on page 4, the four focus mindfulness, the four right efforts, the roads to power, the five spiritual factors, the five mental powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, the four noble eightfold path, especially 3 to 6. Many thanks for the many elaborations and fitting into the larger picture of the teaching. Okay. Yes, you can have elaboration on all of that. It is going to be... some of these things will be mentioned later on, because I will be talking about things that are very related to this. Okay, so let's try to elaborate a little bit. Let's start with the seven factors of enlightenment, okay? Seven factors of awakening here. So the seven factors of awakening start off, they're called the Sambojangas in Pali. Sambojanga is a factor of awakening. And the first one is the Sati Sambojanga. Sati means mindfulness, so the factor of awakening, which is mindfulness. So what does that mean? And what that means is basically Satipatthana practice. When you read the Anapanasati Sutta, you see you do mindfulness of breathing. The mindfulness of breathing fulfills the Satipatthana, and the Satipatthana in turn fulfills, or it gives rise to, the seven factors of awakening here. So it starts off with Satipatthana practice as the basis. Right? Then the second factor of the seven factors of awakening is the Dhamma Vichaya Sambojanga, which means investigation of qualities, sometimes called investigation of states. I don't really like that. I prefer investigations of qualities. These are the mental qualities that we have. And it is defined in terms of knowing the dark and the bright qualities, the blameworthy and blameless qualities. That's enough to give you an idea. In other words, the positive and the negative sides in the mind, right? And that fits very well with the Sati Sambojanga. If you remember the Satipatthana Sutta, the very last part of the Satipatthana Sutta is understanding the five hindrances and also contemplating the seven Sambojangas. Right, that's the Dhamma, under the Dhamma Nupassana section, with the contemplation of Dhammas in Satipatthana, the most prominent things there is investigation of the five hindrances and also the investigation of the seven factors of awakening here. Right? That is, the seven hindrances are the dark qualities I was just talking about. The factors of awakening are the bright ones. The absence of the hindrances are the bright qualities. The absence of the bojangas are the dark ones. So these are the dark and the bright qualities and the counterparts, right? Or you can say the blameless and the blameworthy qualities and the counterparts is what you see there. So you can see here how this fits beautifully in with the Satipatthana Sutta and the Bojangas. The beginning of the Bojangas is nothing else but the last part of the Satipatthana that you do according to Satipatthana Suttas. So you start with Satipatthana and you build up into the Bojangas. This is what you can see here. These things kind of overlap with each other to some extent. Yeah? And of course that is where Satipatthana ends. It ends with the contemplation of the five hindrances and also a little bit of the Bojangas. And at this point, once you have understood the five hindrances, you have abandoned those, you have done the Dhamma Vichaya Sambojanga, the investigation of state, you have done that to overcome the hindrances. That is when the mind starts to become very bright and very beautiful. It is the hindrances, it is the defilements of the mind that keep the mind down, keep the mind dark, keep the mind in a state of lack of joy and lack of mindfulness. Energy, joy and mindfulness tend to arise together. When you have energy, you feel joyful. When you have joyful, you have energy. When you are joyful, you have mindfulness, right? Because you're happy to be here. When you're happy to be here, it's easy to be mindful. So that's why the next factor of the bhujangas is that virya sambhujanga, the energy in the mind starts to become powerful. The hindrances are gone. The mind is pure. And from that energy comes then the piti sambhujanga, which is the sambhujanga of rapture or joy or gladness, if you like. Yeah, because when you have energy, gladness is just there around the corner. When you have no hindrances, both energy and gladness come together. And sometimes you may have experienced this in your meditation practice when you become really peaceful. And sometimes you can feel this strong sense of rapture going through the body, right? When that happens, you know that this is a very beautiful state and you feel quite strongly present at that particular point because it's a very pleasant and very delightful state when you get there. And then you continue, right? Remember that we're doing meditation now. This is all about meditation practice. So at this point, you're watching the breath most likely. And as you watch the breath, that piti comes together with the breath. As you keep on watching the breath, the piti starts to calm down and you move into pasadi. This is the pasadi sambhujanga, factor of awakening. You calm down, right? The mind becomes even more peaceful, becomes even more blissful, because the piti has a certain sense of coarseness to it, going through the physical body, etc. But when the pasadi comes, you become very, very peaceful. You start to feel like a rock, but a rock that is a mindful rock, right? And you feel so content, so happy. You don't want to go anywhere. You just sit there like this kind of stone, and nobody's moving you. There was a famous, somebody told me that once in Thailand, Ajahn Brahm has always been a very, very good meditator. And the story is, he was sitting on the stage, right? They would sit on the stage, the monks and all the lay people would be there. And there was one night when Ajahn Brahm would sit there, and people thought he had died. They were sitting up, they were seeing him on the stage, but he didn't move, right? There was no breath, there was nothing. He was absolutely still for hour after hour after hour. And people getting worried, he must have died. Nothing is happening. But this is what happens, right? When you get into very deep states of meditation, the body becomes incredibly still, rock solid. And this is what can happen in these kind of things. Hour after hour after hour, almost as if you are some kind of Ashokan pillar, just standing there, dang, planted in the ground, right? No movement, the Brahm pillar. Ajahn Brahm pillar. So this is the pasadi. And of course, it gets even deeper when you get into samadhi, which is the next sambhujanga, the samadhi sambhujanga, because when you have that tranquility of the body, you feel very powerful bliss inside, and that powerful bliss is the glue that takes you into samadhi practice. You cannot avoid getting into samadhi anymore because it is so beautiful. You don't want to be in the past, you don't want to be in the future. You get drawn in to this beautiful state. And now we're talking about the jhanas. From the samadhi sambhujanga, you move into the upeka sambhujanga. And of course, the upeka is the high jhana states, third and fourth jhana, when the mind is completely even. You go beyond positive feeling and negative feelings. You have no attachment to those things anymore. And the mind is completely even and easy. And that is when you have the ability to have real insight. Because when the mind is completely even and very powerful, it means that you can watch without reaction. You don't allow the mind no longer, is no longer capable of, the mind no longer is attracted or repelled by things because of a very powerful mind that is completely even. So you watch. And this is one of the meanings of the word upeka. What meaning one is even-mindedness. The second meaning is watching on, observing. You're observing with complete neutrality without allowing yourself to be trapped one way or the other. That's why upeka is so powerful for insight. And this is, in the suttas, the meaning of bhujanga or sambhujanga is actually the things that lead to awakening. not the factors of awakening in the sense that they are part of the awakening experience, but factors of awakening in the sense that they lead you to awakening, right? And we can see how all of this has to do with samatha practice, how it has to do with samadhi. All of this is really samadhi practice, starting off with the meditation on the breath, which is the satipatthanas, going through all the stages of happiness and bliss, eventually reaching the high jhana states. All the four jhanas are part of the Noble Eightfold Path, so you reach the upekkha, which is the fourth jhana, and that is when you have the best chance of reaching awakening here. Yeah, so this is how the Sambhujangas work in brief. There are other ways of looking at them. You can look at the bhujangas at the very beginning. It doesn't necessarily have to be satipatthana that you start out with. It can also be that you start out with a recollection of the Buddha. That's another way of doing the bhujangas. And from the recollection of the Buddha, the mind is completely purified from the hindrances. You have the energy, you have the piti. Then comes the whole thing, right? Tranquility all the way up to upekkha. But based on a slightly different thing, these are the anusatis, the recollection, very closely related to sati, and that's why that is an alternative way of doing it. Could be sila nusati, chaga nusati, buddha nusati, dhamma nusati, all these kind of things. A recollection of something here, basically. So that's the bhujangas for you. Very powerful and very beautiful teaching here. Then we have the indriyas. The indriyas, five indriyas and the five balas. Ooh, how much time have we got? The five indriyas and the five balas. These are two different sets, but they actually mean the same thing. There is no distinction between the five balas and the five indriyas. So these are called the faculties. In other words, these are the powers or the abilities that the mind has when the mind reaches a certain stage. And the balas and the faculties are usually said to be acquired when somebody becomes an Arya, when they become a noble person. Then you actually acquire these faculties for the first time. So the first faculty is, of course, the confidence and the faith in the Buddha. Right? And that confidence and faith in the Buddha only really happens fully once you become a stream enterer, or at the very least you are what they call in the Sutta Dhammanusari or Sadhanusari, which is the first stage before you become a stream enterer, the first stage of being an Arya, when you are bound to become a stream enterer in that same life. Dhammanusari and Sadhanusari, they have the Sad Indriya, the indriya of confidence or the indriya of faith. It becomes a power. You can see why it's called a faculty or a power. Because once you have seen the truth for yourself, you have full confidence in the Buddha, all you have to do is to recollect that. Because you know already, you have seen it for yourself, so you recollect it. You recollect a reality that you have seen. And because you are recollecting a reality that you have seen, it tends to give rise to joy and happiness, because you know the truth of these things. You know the truth of the Dhamma. You know how to apply yourself. You know where real happiness is. You know where suffering is. You know that you have found this astonishing teaching that gives you all the happiness that can ever be experienced by a human being. You know that in your heart. Of course you're going to feel happy when you know that. Right? It's just natural. You know all the rubbish in the world, on the one hand, and you know all the real gold in the world, on the other hand. The gold that is found in the mind by practicing in the right way. So this is the Sad Indriya, and because you have that faith, and you understand what the Buddha really is, what the Dhamma is, you have the joy in the mind, you have the energy which comes with that joy, and that energy is the second of the Indriyas. Very similar to the previous sequence with the Bhujangas, right? From the Saddha comes the energy, because, yeah, I know, I understand. You feel energized, the hindrances disappear, the mind is energetic. And because the mind is energetic, sati, mindfulness arises. Energy, joy, mindfulness, these things revolve around each other and are very similar kind of aspects. And the mind tends to have all of these things at the same time. Yeah, from mindfulness comes samadhi. Why is that? Because remember when we do the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness comes first. Once you have mindfulness, then you practice watching the breath. When you watch the breath, that takes you to samadhi. Noble Eightfold Path, Sammasati leads to Sammasamadhi. Sati always is the condition, the cause for samadhi. One comes after the other one. Without sati, samadhi is impossible. Without samadhi, sati is still possible. Sati comes first. And that's why when I recommend you to do your meditation practice, sit back and wait and allow the sati, the mindfulness, to rise first of all, because then you are ready to do the meditation practice proper. Yeah? So the right steps are so important here. Right thing at the right time, and then your meditation is going to work. So from sati comes samadhi. Not the other way around. Well, of course, samadhi also improves sati, but the basis is sati. From samadhi comes the panya indriya, the faculty of wisdom. Faculty of wisdom is, again, the seeing, the direct insight into the Buddha's teachings. It ties in with the saddha at the beginning, and they reinforce each other. The stronger the wisdom, the stronger the confidence and the faith. The stronger the confidence and faith, the stronger the wisdom. You will notice there's a very interesting thing about the Buddha's teachings. Very often in most kind of religions and teachings, faith is like an independent thing that you have, which is completely separate from everything else. You just have faith in God or whatever it is that you're supposed to have faith in, right? In Buddhism, faith is not independent. Faith and wisdom go together. The more wisdom you have, the more faith you have. The more faith you have, the more wisdom you have. Why? It's because it's not the kind of faith that other religions talk about. It's more like confidence in the fact that you know what is truly going on. There's a different kind of confidence, a different kind of faith. So that's why wisdom and faith actually go hand in hand in the Buddha's teachings. And this is something that makes Buddhism quite unique, I think, and quite different from other teachings that you find in the world. It's a very interesting kind of distinction there. Now, one of the things that you will have noticed when I was talking about this is that both the bhujangas and also the indriyas, they are structured, right? You will notice I have said one thing leading to the next one. And this is one of those very important things in Buddhism, that all of these sets of faculties we're talking about here, whether it is the Noble Eightfold Path, the bhujangas, the indriyas, even the satipatthanas, there is a sequence, and one thing leads to the next one. It's not random, they're not put together in a kind of haphazard way or anything like that. It is structured very precisely, one thing leading to the next one. But it's not an entirely linear process. There's also feedback loops, right? So if you think about the Noble Eightfold Path, you have to have some degree of right view to even get started. But once you get started and the other factors start to come into existence, they feed back and improve right view at the beginning. They feed back and improve the virtue, which is factor number 3, 4, and 5 on the Noble Eightfold Path. So there is a linear progression, but also a feedback at the same time. So it's quite a complex relationship between all of these factors on the Noble Eightfold Path, the bhujangas and the indriyas and all of that. Okay, the last one is the four, I don't like translation, roads to power, the four factors of supernormal power, something like that. These are really things that have to do with samadhi practice. And what these teachings are about, there are different ways of reaching samadhi. One is the chanda samadhi, the samadhi which is based on a wholesome desire. You have the virya samadhi, the samadhi based on energy. Chitta samadhi, the samadhi based on application of the mind. And you have the vimamsa samadhi, the samadhi that comes from investigation of phenomena, investigating things. So these are just different ways that samadhi arises. The chanda samadhi from desire just means that you start off with a certain amount of desire, right? It's important to remember that desire, chanda, has different meaning from kama, which is normal sensual desire. Chanda here is a wholesome kind of desire. It's a desire for awakening, a desire to move forward on the path. And sometimes if you're going to meditate, if you're going to practice, you have to have a little bit of desire first of all, right? If I didn't have any desire to come to KL, I would still be in Perth. So I have to do it. If you didn't have any desire to come here, you wouldn't be here. You would be back home and you would do whatever. So everything wholesome that we do, some desire is required there. And this is also true sometimes in meditation. So that desire becomes then the foundation for the practice of samadhi. Virya samadhi. I can't even remember the full formula. The full formula of the Idipadas is quite long. Virya samadhi, sankara, padana, samanagata, something like that. It's a very long formula. But I know the basic meaning of these things. The virya samadhi is the samadhi which comes from energy, right? You practice in the right way, you feel energized because the hindrances are low, because you're living well, you're doing the right things. And then based on that energy, you kind of sit down and you meditate on that. And that's one of the things that you find, is that if your meditation is going well, your samadhi is coming together, you start feeling very energetic, right? You start feeling like a nuclear reactor inside. This is Ajahn Brahm told me that once. Oh, I feel like a nuclear reactor. Okay, so this is this is like really, really energetic. Yeah. And this is kind of when you come out from the jhana states. So the energy is the basis, or just the application of the mind, the mental application where the mind is very similar to the previous one, and you're just applying the mind in your meditation practice, the citta samadhi. And then the last one is the vimamsa samadhi, and that is actually using reflection, using investigation to reach samadhi as well. And this can be done in many different ways. But the basic idea is that you reflect to abandon all the unwholesome states. And if you reflect in the right way, perhaps you're doing a reflection on anicca, a reflection on death, a reflection that on these kind of profound aspects of the Dhamma. And when you reflect on these things in the right way, because they give rise to a certain appreciation and insight into the Dhamma, all the hindrances just bang, gone, right? Completely annihilated. If you remember anicca in the right way, whatever it is, then these things can be annihilated on the spot, using the wisdom power to drive you towards samadhi. So this is what those things essentially are about. I wouldn't worry too much about these things, because really all you have to do is to sit back and watch the breath, and things should happen on that basis. These are more like signposts and guide maps to ensure that you are on the right track, right? That's really what it's about. All you have to do is make sure that you are maximum virtuous, and then watch the breath. Keep it simple. Don't kind of get too much into all these things. And then with simplicity, it's much easier to make progress on the path. If you think about all these things, oh, after a while, your head is going to kind of, you know, you sit in them, oh, which Sambhojanga is this I'm into now? Right? Oh, meditation finished already. That's you had it. Okay. So those were the four, especially. That means I don't have to do the other ones, right? I'm off the hook for the other ones. Is that right? Great. Thank you very much. We're going to talk about the other ones anyway. So that's good that we had a look at those ones. I hope the next question is a little bit shorter, otherwise we're in serious trouble. There are three types of feeling: pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. How do we know that the feeling is neutral? Okay, that's a good question, because it is not very easy to know that. A lot of the time we are deluded about neutral feelings. And one of the things that we are deluded about, we don't recognize the beauty of neutral feelings. So really the best way to appreciate the neutral feelings is to get into deep samadhi, right? After the fourth jhana, that is when you understand what neutral feeling really is about. So get to the fourth jhana first of all, right? Then you will really know what these things are about. But this is one of those amazing and remarkable things about the Buddha's teachings. According to the formula for the jhanas, when you get to the third jhana, you experience the highest kind of happy feeling that is possible to experience in samsara. The happy feeling inside is the happiest thing that anyone can experience in samsara. And then you go from the third jhana to the fourth jhana, the happy feeling stops. What you have instead is neutral feeling, and that neutral feeling is more happy than the happy feeling you had before. It's better, right? And this is what I mean by the Dhamma is so profound, because it's so hard to understand how a neutral feeling can be more pleasant than a happy feeling. It's like when you feel joyful, you feel, wow, it's so wonderful to feel joyful. And here the Buddha is saying, forget about joy, neutral feeling is better. Right? This is what he's saying. And the only way to really understand that is to kind of go through all the samadhi stages and see what happens as you do that. Otherwise, it is very hard to appreciate what neutral feeling is about. In our ordinary life, neutral feelings feel kind of dull and boring and nothing at all, right? Oh, yuck, more neutral feeling. Give me some pleasure anytime. That is really the way to go about that. Okay. Question number two. Sankhara has different meaning in different contexts. Can Bhante explain further? Okay. So, the two main meanings of the word sankhara, there are some minor meanings as well, but two main meanings. And the main meaning of sankhara, it means will. Right? The doer inside of you. Choice. Whenever you make a choice, then the will is coming into action. Should I do A? Should I do B? Right? Okay, I'm going to do A. That's the will coming in and doing something. That is sankhara. Sankhara quite literally means to put together or to create something. Kara comes from the verb karoti, which means to make, and sang is a prefix to that, which means like putting together, making together, creating, fabricating things. And of course, the point here is that every time you have an act, you make a choice, you are making kamma. So you are creating your future through those sankharas, depending on what kind of will you have. Whether it is a will motivated by bad things or a will motivated by good things. Good things, good kamma. Bad things, bad kamma. So do the good things. Otherwise, you're going to be your own friend. Don't be your own enemy, as I said earlier on today here. So that is one meaning of sankhara. And that meaning is the meaning you find when we talk about the five khandhas, right? That is the meaning in the five khandhas. It means the will. That is the meaning in dependent origination. Second factor, sankhara, it means the will. That is the most common meaning in the suttas of the word sankhara. Second meaning is when we say, for example, sabba sankhara anicca. All sankharas are impermanent. In that case, it refers to all compounded things. Because remember, sankhara means to put together. So it also refers to those things that are put together, are created, are fabricated as well. It refers to the act of creation, but also the result of the creation, the things that are created. And when you say sabbe sankhara anicca, it refers to the result of that creating activity. You have produced something. So when you say sabbe sankhara anicca, all creations are impermanent, all creations are suffering, you're talking about everything in experience. Because everything in our experience has been created by us through our past karma. That's why we experience those things now. This is the second meaning of sankhara. Third meaning of sankhara, this is actually much more rare. And this is when sankhara means more something like a force. Right, it's a kind of general force innate, like we talked about before today, the Ayu Sankhara, the life force. That's actually the word Sankhara as well. But this is a much more rare usage of the word Sankhara. And if you remember the two main meanings I have just talked about now, then you are basically in business. You know what Sankhara is all about. So every time you make a choice, right? Okay, Sankhara, Sankhara, Sankhara. Some people say that Sankhara means thought. And that is, it's true that there is a lot of sankhara in the thinking mind, because whenever you think, you choose to think, it is your choice, right? So there is a lot of sankhara involved in thinking. But the thinking itself is only a small aspect of sankhara. Sankhara is much wider than that. You don't have to think for it to be sankhara. You can make pre-verbal choices and that sort of thing, yeah. Mental formation. Yeah, I think that's a terrible translation. It's so hard to understand, right? Mental formation. When I kind of hear these kind of things, I kind of tune out because I don't really know what it's talking. Sometimes I also use volitional formations, right? And I because I was working a little bit with Bhikkhu Bodhi when he was actually quite a lot with him when he was translating the Anguttara Nikaya, and I said, I don't understand volitional formation, and if I don't understand, I've been a monk for 20 years, who is going to understand it? That's what I said to him. I think I understand, but it's not, when you read it, it doesn't kind of leap out, think, wow, yeah, I understand this. It's almost the exact opposite. So that's why he has changed that translation to activities. I think he calls it volitional activities now, which is much more easy to understand. You act, your activities, you act, and they are driven by the will. So willed activities is what it really refers to. I think it's so important to translate the suttas in a way whereby everybody can understand what's happening, otherwise it kind of becomes pointless, I think. Okay. There are five spiritual faculties and four mental powers, actually. Please explain the difference. These are the same, both Panchabala. Actually, I think what you mean is Panchabala and Panchaindriya is probably what you mean, the five faculties and the five powers. And in the suttas, they are basically explained to be the same thing. I don't know why they occur twice. It is possible, perhaps, that maybe the Buddha started using one word, and then maybe later on they went on to use another one, so you ended up with two separate categories. But really, they are the same thing. The suttas say that they are. That's what they are. So that kind of reduces the 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas down to 32. That's good news, isn't it? Simplify things a little bit. It can't hurt. Okay, how can we be a refuge unto ourselves to be independent when we live in society where everyone is interdependent to survive? Yes, it is hard, isn't it? It is really not easy to be a refuge unto yourself. And especially, as you say, when you live in the world, it is easier for monastics, but even for monastics it's hard to be entirely a refuge unto yourself. It means that you are practicing Satipatthana, presumably you have even Samadhi, right? That is when real independence can happen. You can really go inside of yourself and find all the happiness and everything you need from inside. And this is what you see when you see some of the great monks and nuns in the world who live far away in the jungle, live incredibly simple lives. And yet, they're very happy and blissed out as people. You know that the bliss comes from inside. They are independent of external phenomena. So what you have to do as a layperson, you have to just keep on doing the right thing. Live well. And the most important thing to do is to remember the sila. Be kind. Think kind thoughts. Learn how to deal with your mind in such a way that the mind becomes more positive, more accepting, more understanding of people around you, right? If you can practice the sila in a good way, you will find that you become more independent, more happy, and your meditation will become more profound as a result of that. And then every time you go on a meditation retreat, you think, yay, my meditation is improving, hooray, so happy, right? Isn't that wonderful when that happens? You go on the retreat, you can actually see the progress. And if you don't see the progress, you should ask yourself, why? Why are things stagnating? Because there will be a reason for that. And the reality is that we have to be brutally honest with ourselves. We can't just, kind of close our eyes, I don't want to see my own faults. Most people are like that, don't want to see their own faults, right? But we have to, if we're going to make progress, we have to be honest with ourselves. It's okay to accept our own faults. Everybody is flawed in this world. Doesn't make you a worse person. In fact, it makes you a better person because you're trying to change. You're trying to do something positive in your life. And then if you do that, if you're honest with yourself, you see your own faults, and you then change and you make yourself a better person as a consequence, you will make progress in this way. And as you do that, this independence will slowly come to you as well, even as a layperson. It may not be quite as fast as a monastic, but it will come slowly, slowly, slowly if you do things in the right way. Make sure that you get enough inspiration to keep you on the right path. This is one of the crucial things on this path. Question, what is one good state of mind at time of death? So we can die well with an unconfused mind, but direct it to a good rebirth in a pleasant state. Okay, well, the most important thing about mental states at the time of the death is what, how you live your life now. That is what really matters. In the suttas, but the suttas don't talk so much about the state of mind when we die. The only thing the suttas really talk about is what kind of karma we make in this life. It is in the commentaries that they talk about the four kinds of death karma, the death proximate karma, the kind of accumulated karma, the powerful karma, these kind of things. It's all from the commentaries. I know a lot of people know about these things, but it's actually not from the suttas. What really matters in this, according to the suttas, is just the general karma that you make in this life. So make sure you make heaps of good karma and an absolute minimum of bad karma. And if you do that, you will be ready when you die, and the mindfulness will come automatically as part of the dying process. Otherwise, unless you have that mindfulness, there is no way that you will be able to choose anything at all. You can't really choose anything because your mind will automatically be confused because of your bad actions. Yeah, so really, max out on the good karma in this life. And then there is some chance that you will die in a good way when that time eventually comes. So you don't need to direct yourself very much to a good rebirth, because this will happen pretty much automatically. You will just move on to a good rebirth because your karma is good already. Don't have to worry too much about that anymore. Okay, so if you're not happy with that answer, please come back to me and we can discuss that more at some other time. Okay, in daily meditation, my mind chatters incessantly. What can I do to stop this mental talking, to manage the compulsive thinking mind? Okay, my mind chatters incessantly. So why does your mind chatter incessantly? It's because you want to chatter incessantly. It's terrible, isn't it? Oh, no. That is the truth. You will these things into existence. And we all, it's not just you, everybody has that problem, right? I'm not kind of singling you out, anything like that. Everybody has that problem to some extent. And so for that reason, you don't have to feel bad about anything like that. But basically, it's because we want to do it. And the reason why we want to do it is because we find some kind of happiness there, right? Some kind of meaning, some kind of sense that this is important to us. So one of the things that Two things that we can do. One is to change your priorities. Remember what is really important in life, what is really going to take you somewhere useful. And when you are sitting down to meditate, you are much closer to the meaning of life than you are in ordinary life. Ordinary life is there to support your meditation. Your meditation is not so much there to support your ordinary life. Now is when you come the closest to the Buddha's teachings. When you meditate is when you come the closest to Nibbana, when you come the closest to real meaning and real happiness. That's the theory anyway, right? Sometimes the mind is chattering and you wonder whether it's really true. That's kind of the way we're trying to get to. So remember that. This is priority number one. And if you're able to prioritize the meditation practice, the other things take less priority, it is more likely your mind will be peaceful. The other thing that is really crucial here is to find some happiness in the meditation. When I gave the instructions this morning, I started out with the idea of happiness. Once you understand the idea of happiness, then you can trace back and you can see why certain things work and why other things don't work in a meditation. The more happiness you have, the more developed your virtue is, the more generous you have been in your life, the more you have avoided all the bad things, the more easy it is to feel joy in a meditation practice. That joy is far more powerful than your thinking mind. When you feel joy, you don't want to think anymore, because the thinking will destroy the joy. So in that case, you have something better. And when you have something better, the thinking starts to die away here. So this is why the path is so integrated, why sila and erosity and all of these things are integrated with the meditation practice, because these are the things that enable you to stay in the present moment, stay with the object of meditation, overcome the sloth and torpor, overcome the thinking, and all of these kind of things. So spiritual happiness and giving preference to the spiritual path and the meditation, right? Giving priority to that. Those are two of the things that will work out. Okay, last question for tonight. Yes? Okay. In Ajahn Mun's biography, it was written that the Buddha and Arahants came to him to teach him whilst he was in deep meditation. Ajahn Suchart reasoned that this had happened too in his recording on YouTube. Okay, is this possible since Mahaparinibbana means the Buddha had entered Nibbana and had ceased to be? This is a very good question. And he said it. Ajahn Suchart said reasoned that this had happened too in his recording on YouTube. Oh, okay, I see. Well, I think the problem here is that there's many problems here, right? There's a number of things that are possible explanations for this. First of all, Ajahn Mun's biography was written by Ajahn Mahabua. Ajahn Suchart is a disciple of Ajahn Mahabua. Right, so we're going a long way from the source here. So what actually originally happened is very, very hard to know. So this is my take on this. I take this to be Ajahn Mahabua's understanding of Ajahn Mun. Right, so exactly what Ajahn Mun experienced, nobody actually knows. But the idea that Buddhas came to him, it really came to him, I think, obviously is impossible. That cannot be the explanation. There must be some other explanation. So I would say what is very likely to have happened is that Ajahn Mun, he had some nimitta, he had some vision of the Buddha and Arahants coming to him, right? And that vision, that is then what later on he communicated to other monks. He said, oh, I was meditating, the Buddha came to me, right? It's just a manner of speech, perhaps. Or perhaps he even said that I had this nimitta, but maybe it was misunderstood or whatever. Or maybe even Ajahn Mahabua means it in that way. There are so many possibilities. But that is what I take to be the meaning behind this. And if you read, for example, many of the Mahayana suttas will often say at one time the Buddha was staying at the vulture peaks in Rajagaha, surrounded by 1 million bodhisattvas and countless navutis. It's a kind of enormous number of devas and all these kind of things. And sometimes you wonder, where do these things come from? We know the Buddha didn't say this, because these suttas have a very different vocabulary, a very different literary style from the early suttas. They're obviously very developed from the early times. And one possibility that has been suggested by scholars, which I take quite seriously, that these were actually visions that people had in their meditation, right? They had a vision of previous Buddhas. They had a vision of bodhisattvas. They saw these things. And because they saw them, they felt that they had the right to write these things down as realities, and they became suttas. So for them, it was real. They really felt that they had seen these things. They really felt that they had seen the Buddhas of the past, right? So it's not really fraud. It's not as if they kind of just made things out of thin air, but they made things based on their own experience without perhaps investigating clearly enough what that experience actually meant and writing that into suttas. So this is what I say happened with Ajahn Mun's biography. If the Buddha was still around, why would Ananda cry when he died, right? No need to cry. Just say, oh, the Buddha, come back, I will talk to you later on, right? No worries. But Ananda is crying, and then you have Venerable Aniruddha is there. Aniruddha says, oh, why cry? All conditioned phenomena are impermanent. They must pass away. Aniruddha was an arahant, and he is saying the Buddha is impermanent. Of course he's passing away. He didn't say, don't worry, the Buddha will come back afterwards, right? He says the Buddha is impermanent. So we have to be very careful when you read these kind of biographies and these kind of things that come from teachers, you have to be very careful and remember this is not the word of the Buddha. This is a particular interpretation by a particular teacher, and it needs to be understood in the light of the suttas. Only then can you come to right interpretation of these things. Otherwise, we will be in serious trouble. And this is why it is so useful to read the suttas, right? Then you have some way of kind of deciding on these difficult issues. And this is what it is really all about. Okay, so are you all exhausted now? Yeah. Anyway, I think we better call it a day, because tomorrow is another day. But before we do that, let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and let's do the Arahant Sammasambuddha together. Do you do that here? You know, yeah? Okay, so let's do that together.